Welcome to X-Men Unraveled, the podcast that follows the stories of the X-Men in chronological order. I'm your host, Noelle. Today's episode is really important in the story of the X-Men because issue number 14 of Uncanny X-Men introduces one of the team's most significant and enduring foes, the mutant-hunting Sentinels. They are robots with advanced computing and AI processes who ruthlessly seek out mutants for capture and extermination. They were created by humans afraid of the growing number of mutants and their potential threat to the species of Homo sapien. The Sentinels are introduced in a plotline that runs from issues 14 to 16 of Uncanny X-Men, but their threat to mutants extends over the decades of comics published afterward. What I found online said they have over 700 appearances. Part of what makes the Sentinels so significant is that they really embody the ultimate threat that mutants face from humans, genocide. Humans in the comics continue to fear mutants over the years and what this step in evolution means for Homo sapiens and their power. I think because of that significance, the Sentinels make frequent appearance in X-Men media off the page as well. The one that stands out to me and is really the image I think of when I imagine the Sentinels is from the very first episode of the 90s animated series. In the show, they're giant robots relentlessly pursuing mutants to bring into custody, and they're chasing down the young mutant, Jubilee. They initially try to snatch her out of her room, but she's not home, so they follow her to the mall where they crash into the arcade where she's playing video games. Luckily, the X-Men are nearby to rescue her. And since it's the first episode, it's such a good intro to the X-Men and the status of mutants, and I just remember when I was a kid thinking that the Sentinels would be so terrifying. They're not really, like, scary looking beyond being giant robots, but imagining being hunted by them always stood out to me since I was pretty little when I watched it. And when I picture the Sentinels in my head, I cannot help but think of the ones from the show. The Sentinels also appear in the 2014 movie Days of Future Past, where they have nearly completed the total genocide of mutants. The movie also introduces the most important character in the Sentinels' history, their original creator and all-out anti-mutant zealot, Oliver Trask. In the movie, he's played by Peter Dinklage, who does such a good job that I cannot stand him in the film. He's too good of an actor, and it makes me hate his character so goddamn much. And Trask is very hateable. He's absolutely riddled with anti-mutant hatred, which leads him to create the Sentinels in the first place. Imagine the hatred you would have to feel to build machines to hunt and capture a specific group of people. I can't even begin. But Bolivar's got some skeletons in his closet that I'll cover in this episode, which complicate his relationship to mutants and is missing from the movie. In the end, Trask and the Sentinels are integral to the history of the X-Men and the experience of mutants in general, so I want to make sure to give enough space to the origin of the Sentinel menace. To do that, rather than covering the issues of Uncanny X-Men, which introduced the Sentinels all at once today, I'm splitting this into two episodes. Today, I'm going to start with the opening pages of Uncanny X-Men number 14, and then dive into the background of Bolivar Trask. And next episode, I'll cover the X-Men's first experience facing the Sentinels. So, let's get into it. The cover of Uncanny X-Men number 14 features a Sentinel, a large humanoid robot, looming over Professor Xavier in a TV studio, while the X-Men are arriving through a window in the background. And depending on which model of Sentinel you think of first, these original Sentinels are a little different from later versions. My best guess, they're about 10 feet tall, they're designed like they're wearing blue leotards and boots while their arms and legs are red, their heads and faces are yellow, and they have like very strange immobile faces with defined cheekbones for some reason, and they have red helmets with this yellow ridge above their eyes. But despite the clear danger on the cover, things start out pretty casually at the beginning of the issue. The X-Men are all just healing up from their major injuries sustained in their fight with Juggernaut last issue, so they're training, but in a limited capacity. Beast is on crutches, Angel's stuck in some giant harness, and Iceman is getting to chill out in an ice intensifier machine to rebuild the strength of his powers. I really don't know what is going on with Scott. He's sitting in a chair wearing some kind of astronaut helmet hooked up to what looks to be an oxygen tank. It's not explained, and I don't know what's going on. Jean, on the other hand, was kept out of most of the fighting by Xavier, but is recovering from the strain of using so much of her power at the end of the fight. And honestly, she's probably the only one who's been, like, doing much work recently since Xavier had her fill in as nurse for the rest of the team. But by this issue, they've all healed up well, and Xavier announces that they get to go on vacation. When he made his announcement, I kind of thought that he meant he was sending them away somewhere, like, tropical to relax, but he really just means that they get a break and they are all leaving the mansion to do their own thing. We see the team all prepare to leave and get a look at what preparations mutants have to make to pass in the world as human. Iceman is helping Angel strap his wings down to hide underneath his regular clothes, Scott exchanges his visor for his ruby glasses, and Beast puts on his specially made shoes to help his feet. Once they're all ready, the X-Men head off in their different directions. Hank and Bobby are going into the city and make their way to their favorite coffee shop that we've seen a couple of times now. Warren and Jean are both heading to the train station, so he offers to give Jean a ride, but she really wants to try and spend time with Scott, so she invites him to tag along. Scott does want to go with her, but declines, reminding himself that his powers make him too much of a danger to anyone else, so he can't get too close to Jean. So Jean leaves with Warren, and Scott walks off alone, handing Xavier the newspaper on his way out. The headline that day is Mutant Menace, and the article details the theories of anthropologist Bolivar Trask, who says that mutants are a threat to humans' very existence. He says in his interview that mutants are preparing to strike and could enslave humanity if they're not stopped. There's images in the article as well, and they show mutants as these, like, alien-esque beings using humans as forced labor and making them perform in gladiator contests. All of these images are what Trask believes mutants could do to humans if left unchecked. As Xavier is reading, he's getting more and more furious and worried about the panic that Trask's beliefs will cause in society. So he immediately dials up the National Television Network and demands a televised debate with Bolivar Trask from the programming director. He wants to challenge Trask's views in a public venue. His demand is granted pretty easily, possibly through the use of his powers. He's really just some rando calling in, so I am inclined to believe so. And in the very next scene, Xavier is in a TV studio, sitting at a table with the TV host and Bolivar Trask. When the debate starts, Xavier presents his views first and tries to convince the audience of the humanity of mutants and downplay their threat by saying that a mutant is merely a person who was born with different power or ability than the average human. He goes on to say that no one knows the causes of these mutations, so anyone, including the children of viewers, could be a mutant. We then get a panel of the reaction of viewers on the street, and they are not thrilled about Xavier's message. One woman says, "No kid of mine is a mutie," while another man accuses Xavier of calling the public ignorant. Two other men are debating whether Xavier is a communist or a right-winger, so Xavier's message is not really hitting home with most listeners. The host then gives the floor to Trask, who accuses Xavier of either being blind to the threat of mutants or having an ulterior motive. And of course, we know that he is actually right in that second guess, because Xavier can pass as human since his mutation and powers are not visible. But Trask isn't really interested in the debate itself. He uses his time to introduce his newly created defense against the mutant threat, the Sentinels. He brings one out on stage to demonstrate its abilities and states that they are powerful enough to defeat any mutant. He asks the audience to imagine that Xavier is a mutant and orders the Sentinels to apprehend him to show what it could do. Love the irony here. Xavier, either overestimating or misunderstanding his powers, tries to use his telepathy against the robots and seems genuinely surprised that it doesn't work. For a man with PhDs in genetics and biophysics and who worked as a psychologist, I'm really surprised he doesn't realize that robot brains and human brains would not be the same thing. Anyway, Trask says that there is no danger to Xavier because the Sentinel is totally subservient to him. And then he calls out a group of 5 more Sentinels to reveal that he already possesses the means to defend humans from mutants. He says that the Sentinels are equipped with the most complex mechanical thinking apparatus ever constructed. Trask then orders the lead Sentinel to demonstrate how well they obey commands, and in response, the Sentinel blasts Trask with some sort of ray that knocks him out. Just a reminder here, Trask has a PhD in anthropology, not whatever degree would be useful in building advanced AI robots. And I had honestly forgotten that bit before I reread these issues, and it's just absolutely hilarious. No shade to anthropologists, I'm a humanities and social science person myself, but I would not assume that that would make me a great robot creator. And it did not go well for Trask. But Xavier, who is watching Trask's grand plan go to absolute shit, reaches out telepathically to the X-Men for help. The story continues in this issue and the 2 that follow, but I'm going to save that for next time so I can cover a bit about who this Trask guy is. As we've seen, Bolivar Trask is the man who introduces the mutant-hunting Sentinels to the world, but his hatred for mutants goes much further back, which makes sense. He didn't just wake up one day and decide he hates mutants to build a genocide machine. But who is Bolivar, and how did he become the man who would build one of the most dangerous threats to mutants? There isn't much information on his early life. All we really know is that Trask was born in South Dakota and gets his PhD in anthropology. But there is a 1998 series titled Conspiracy, where we learn a bit more about Bolivar's dealings and connections before Uncanny X-Men. This series only has 2 issues, and it was pretty hard to track down, but I was able to find a copy online. One caveat as I cover this, I'm unsure of its canonicity. It's not mentioned in the Marvel bios anywhere for most of the characters involved, aside from Trask. But even if it is, as the name suggests, just a conspiracy, it's one that I enjoyed, and I think it at least holds some kernels of truth. Conspiracy is told from the point of view of an investigative reporter who comes across some old documents hinting at a secret, powerful group called Control. The reporter, Mark Ewing, learns that Control was the brainchild of Reed Richards, pre-Fantastic Four, who wanted to protect the world from the growing number of threats that were emerging, terrestrial, alien, or otherwise. Along with Richards, Control was made up of a group of men all connected to the United States military-industrial complex. There are 3 U.S. generals and a colonel, Howard Stark, and most importantly for us, 1 Bolivar Trask. Control had several goals, all in an effort to protect the world from new threats it faces in the era of superheroes. First, they wanted to contain the news about all the various superpowered or alien threats cropping up to keep it from the public and prevent panic. They also wanted to be the ones to direct events that took place related to superpowered heroes. Without Reed Richards' knowledge, you know, the one who came up with the group, supposedly, Control was the group that created the circumstances of the Fantastic Four gaining their powers. And in another instance, Control intentionally exposed Matt Murdock to the chemical that gave him his powers to become Daredevil. Control also sought to guide the direction of research and scientific developments. If there was a new technology, they wanted to know about it and be in charge of it. So they kept tabs on or worked with numerous individuals involved in important research. Overall, Control sought to surreptitiously guide the trajectory of these new forces in the world while remaining completely unknown. According to one of the generals who was in Control, they became aware of Charles Xavier's theories about mutants. Wanting to be prepared to handle any threat that mutants could pose, Control invested funding into Trask's Sentinels. The series ends with the reader still wondering what's true and what isn't, but I finished it thinking that the parts about Trask have more truth than not. I don't know that anthropology is necessarily the most lucrative career path, so these connections could explain how he had the money and ability to research and develop advanced robots. Later in a story from Adam, Legend of the Blue Marvel, number 2 from 2008, we find out that Trask's connections brought him into high-level conversations in the US government. An unknown hero called Blue Marvel had recently turned up, and Trask went to the Pentagon to discuss the situation with the president. Trask shares that evolutionary changes are taking place in the human genome, giving rise to superpowered individuals. His fear is that mutants will start to appear all over the world, presenting new geopolitical threats if rival countries called upon their own mutants, leading to potential destabilization. His suggestion is to stay wide awake to the threat and be ready to control it. And Trask's term, wide awake, would later inspire a government mutant control project's name. So, using his high-level connections, Trask is able to influence US policy towards mutants generally. And there was no mutant advocate in the room to counter his suggestion like Xavier tried to do in the debate. Through all of this, Trask laid the groundwork for the creation of the Sentinels. But all of this is related to Trask's professional life. There's another element to his relationship to mutants of a much more personal nature, so I will cover that next. The introduction of the Sentinels and Bolivar Trask into the world of the X-Men takes place in issue 14 of Uncanny X-Men. But in later issues, the Sentinels will threaten them again, and we will meet a new character, Bolivar Trask's son, Lawrence. This takes place in Uncanny X-Men 57-59, and it's revealed in those issues that Lawrence himself is a mutant, and Bolivar Trask knew this and hid it from Lawrence. Other events take over those issues, so for more details about Bolivar and his son, we have to go to issue -1 of Uncanny X-Men. Yes, -1. It was published in 1997 and gives us more insight into Bolivar's character. The issue's tagline is "The Boy Who Saw Tomorrow," and it opens with a comic version of Stan Lee introducing the story as the true origin of the X-Men. And it's pretty entertaining to see this version of Stan Lee. The issue tells the story through the eyes of a time-traveling Rachel Summers. Rachel is obviously a member of the complicated family of Scott Summers, but that's about all I'm going to say about her. Her story is way too convoluted and down the road in chronology to even try to get into today. Just know that she travels to the past and sees this story play out. Rachel arrives in South Dakota at the time that Bolivar Trask is still working on his grand project of creating the Sentinels. But that's on hold at this particular moment because he has a more pressing concern, his son Lawrence. When Lawrence was 5, he experienced a vision of his mother's death. Later, when the prediction came true, Bolivar discovered that his son was a mutant. But rather than changing his mind about mutants, Bolivar is racked with shame at the knowledge that his own son is a mutant and decides instead to find a way to hide Lawrence's powers. So he creates a medallion that suppresses Lawrence's powers and keeps him from being detected as a mutant, say, by Sentinels. But it also erases Lawrence's memory of any precognitive events, so the only one who knows he's a mutant is Bolivar. In issue -1, Bolivar has Lawrence strapped to a bed in his lab. Lawrence is unconscious, but his face is grimacing in pain because he's in the middle of a precognitive episode. It seems that Bolivar, despite his anti-mutant stance, is using Lawrence's powers of precognition to learn about events that are coming. When he's through, Bolivar places the large gold medallion on Lawrence, and he immediately appears calm and peaceful once it's around his neck. And this medallion is like so big and gaudy and it's on this big gold chain. I really don't know how he was able to keep Lawrence wearing it all the time, but he does. Exactly how the medallion is supposed to work is not explained, but using some comic science, Bolivar managed to create it. Lawrence will continue wearing this medallion up until he appears in Uncanny X-Men number 58, and so he grows up with his father's prejudiced ideas about mutants. It is super fucked up that Bolivar did this to his son, and in the issue, he says that he wants to protect his child from his powers being exploited, but that's literally what Bolivar is doing. Later, when he's alone, Bolivar pulls out a family photo to reminisce on better times, I guess. And the photo shows Bolivar, his unnamed wife, Lawrence, and a teenage girl posing happily for the picture. The girl is Bolivar's daughter, Tanya, who had gone missing several years before, possibly not long after Lawrence's powers emerged. And it turns out that Tanya was a mutant as well, with both telepathic and time-traveling abilities. So Bolivar's two children both turned out to be mutants, but he never changed his mind about mutants in general. When Tanya's powers emerged, she was unable to control her time-traveling ability, and she would unintentionally slip to different times, which happened repeatedly until one day she was unable to return. Bolivar was aware of her powers, but was unable to help her, and all he knew was that Tanya eventually disappeared. When she vanished, Tanya spent an unknown amount of time drifting through time, and ultimately ended up 3,000 years in the future. There, or then, she meets Rachel Summers and trains with her. Tanya remains in that time and lives out her life, training with Rachel and taking on the name Madame Sanctity. One fun little side note, if you've watched the Loki series, during her life in the future, Tanya holds the title Guardian of the Sacred Timeline. And I'm sure the time slipping also sounds familiar from the show. In Uncanny X-Men Negative One, Tanya has traveled to the time of the issue in order to try and prevent her father from releasing the Sentinels on the world. She appears in her father's lab and reveals to him the truth of her disappearance. And she says that she's not able to stay long, but she wants him to stop his crusade against mutants. However, she doesn't get a chance to really convince him because Rachel Summers stops her in order to prevent damage to the sacred tapestry of time. Rachel erases Bolivar's memory, so he never knows what happened to Tanya or that he ever saw her again. Tanya and Rachel return to the time they traveled from, and Bolivar ends up completing his Sentinel program. And that is the complicated, convoluted backstory of Bolivar Trask. I have some trouble squaring the idea that he has two mutant children and still went on with his Sentinel project, but I'm sure we can all think of some example of a person who holds some conviction that makes them a hypocrite when you look too close at their life. And I think that's just the case with Bolivar. He loves his children and wants to protect them despite the fact that they're mutants, but he is not able to extend that compassion to other mutants who he views as inherently dangerous. And his hatred and prejudice by the time he has children is just too ingrained, and he won't change it at all. As I was thinking about Bolivar's story, I started to wonder if he and Xavier could have been allies if they met under different circumstances. Hear me out, I have real reasons, not just my anti-Xavier prejudice, because as we've seen, one of Xavier's driving concerns is his fear of dangerous mutants and the need to stop them. He and the X-Men are not focused on fighting human threats, they fight other mutants in order to protect humanity. And if you remember back to the Xavier episode, his original motive for his work in building the X-Men team stemmed from the threat he saw in Amal Farouk, better known as the Shadow King, who was a dangerous telepath. After their encounter, Xavier believed it was of the utmost importance to stop evil mutants like the Shadow King. So at its core, I don't think that Xavier's perspective at this time is all that different from Trask. Yes, Xavier does want mutants and humans to coexist, but he also sees the real threat to that goal as coming from the danger of evil mutants like Farouk or Magneto or Unis, contrasted with Magneto, who sees humans' fear as the reason that the two cannot coexist. And how different really is Xavier's strategy from Trask? He uses Cerebro to identify, track, and neutralize those mutants that he deems a threat, like he did on the Blob, who just wanted to be left alone to live as a carny. And we've also seen Xavier repeatedly use his powers unethically against both humans like Johnny Storm and mutants like the Blob by wiping their memories. So you are free to chalk it up to my own hatred for Xavier, but I do think there's some real parallels between him and Trask. But overall, Xavier does some good things, while Trask is just a prejudiced piece of shit who builds genocide machines. As much as I hate him, I do find Bolivar Trask and his children to be very interesting characters, so I hope this backstory was as entertaining for all of you. Next time, I will cover the remainder of Uncanny X-Men 14, along with issues 15 and 16, to finish the story of the X-Men's first encounter with the Sentinels. Until next time, I will post some pictures from the issues to the Instagram at X-Men Unraveled, so go check that out if you're not following already. Thank you for joining me as always, and I will talk to you next time.